Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with longtime New Orleans journalist John Pope. His new book is Getting Off at Elysian Fields, Obituaries from the New Orleans Times-Picayune. We'll also catch up with photographer Cece Lockwood, whose gorgeous new book is Louisiana Wild, The Protected and Restored Lands of the Nature Conservancy. John Pope has been a New Orleans journalist for more than 40 years, and he was recently recognized for his long career with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Press Club of New Orleans. You may know him for his great coverage of the AIDS crisis, as well as the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And one thing's for sure, if you've read the Times-Picayune over the years, you've read one of Pope's wonderful obituaries for the famous, or the interesting, or the merely weird. His new book is Getting Off at Elysian Fields, Obituaries from the New Orleans Times-Picayune. John Pope, I'm so happy to have you on The Reading Life.
I am thrilled to be here.
Now, you are so well known for your obituaries that when you call friends, the first thing you do is reassure them that everything's okay. What do you say?
Hi, it's Pope. Nobody died.
Nobody died. So.
Because people, I can tell people sort of freeze up. Because I've talked with so many people for so long for context.
I don't want you to be a harbinger of bad news, you know. So talk about how you settled into writing obituaries. It's an unusual specialty.
Well, it is. It's a combination of things. I grew up here. So even though I grew up in Metairie, I got an idea over the years of how things fit together in a community. Who belongs with which group, that sort of thing. Then I went away to college where I minored in journalism and got a master's in history. And so those things helped me appreciate the importance of context to show how these people fit into a certain milieu and also just the importance of events in the overall trend of things.
And also you have a sense of the individual contributions those people make to the community, what their great gifts are that they bring to us.
Exactly. Well, for that, I take my text from Linda Lohman in Death of a Salesman when she stood at her husband's grave and said, "Attention must be paid." These are folks who have stories. They may not be carnival monarchs or hardened felons or brilliant philanthropists, but they are important people. My favorite was a Mr. Garibaldi, who had been a letter carrier. And even though he had a college degree, I think in chemistry, he was an African-American, so in the 50s, that was about the best he could hope for. And his daughter, Brenda Hatfield, has been a longtime friend, so she called me when her father died to see about an obituary, and we were chatting away, and she told me about how everyone loved Mr. Garibaldi. I mean, he remembered birthdays, he remembered important events, they asked after his family. And I said, "That's all very good, Brenda, but what else you got?" She thought a minute, she said, "Well, Pope, in World War II, he was a spy."
Yes.
And I went, "Cool." And it turned out he had been assigned in England to pubs along the English Channel, probably pubs where African-American GIs went to see if word of D-Day was leaking out. And then he was also one of the first, if not the first, black members of a Presidential Honor Guard. And that was all fascinating. I thought it was a good story, but the payoff came later when Brenda called me to say that at the funeral, people came up to her and her brother and said, "You never told us this," and she said, "You never asked."
Ah, Pope, that's thrilling. That's really sweet. So let's talk about some of the other folks, you know. Tell us about James Roberts, the embalmer.
Oh, yeah. Well,
James Roberts
could, pardon the expression, put to rest the rumor that Jane Mansfield had been decapitated in the accident that killed her. He could do this because he embalmed her. He lived in Bultman Funeral Homes. He had an apartment just off the casket showroom. So he was always there.
He was.
And so when Ms. Mansfield came in, there she was. He embalmed her. And there was an interview where someone said, "Well, wasn't she decapitated?" He said, I should know. I embalmed her.
That's right.
What people thought they saw was her head and hair, but it was actually one of Jane Mansfield's wigs on its wig stand.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. That is the greatest story. All right. So what about Harry Tervelon?
Harry the waiter. What a wonderful, distinctive man. I'm really proud of that lead about how he dished up waffles and one-liners in Yankee trivia.
Yes.
At the Camellia Grill for more than half a century. And he told corny jokes. He remembered what everyone wanted in his or her coffee. And he was just this font of Yankee trivia. And people didn't know his last name. He was Harry the Waiter
yes.
to loads of people. And he was a Yankees fiend. And his wife bought him, as a birthday present, two seats from the original Yankee Stadium when it was being renovated. He named them Ruth and Gehrig.
Aww.
Well, they were washed away in the Hurricane Katrina flood. Mm-hmm. And he said one of his favorite memories when he was growing up was talking to Lou Gehrig at Pelican Stadium. And he was one of these characters. He'd never held office, but he was what I call part of the warp and woof, the fabric that makes this city the mm-hmm. distinctive place that it is. And because he was a Yankees fan, he was thrilled that he got to meet Billy Martin, who was the often cantankerous, wildly unpredictable manager. And one night, Carlos Marcello kissed him, and Harry said later, "Hope that wasn't the kiss of death."
Oh, God. Carlos Marcello is another one you've written an obit for.
Now, oh, that was just, that was fun. Because Carlos Marcello played against type. He was not Frank Costello. He was not Al Capone. He was not a flashy guy who dressed smartly and went to nightclubs and tossed off one-liners and squired babes around. He was, in his words, a tomato salesman. But he was head of the mob on the Gulf Coast.
Yes.
And it was just a fascinating story to trace. I'm glad you brought up that one because Marcello was one of the obits I had did in advance.
Mm-hmm.
I like doing that because you have time to pull together a well-rounded profile. Although, of course, you never know how much time you're going to get.
Right.
I had one obit ready for 16 years. That was John Schwegman. And then I finished another one 6 hours before the subject died. Talk about working to deadline.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel like a stalker?
Often. I do. But and there were some people who say that doing the obit in advance is cheap and tacky. But I think, and my editors back me up on this, that it's actually flattering that we thought enough of you to devote time to pulling together a rounded picture mm-hmm. of your life. The two I'm proud of are Walker Percy, although I never thought I never got to the center of him, although I worked more than a year on it, and Eudora Welty, which is probably my favorite.
That's my favorite, too. And you worked on that for years.
Mm-hmm, I did. And then she up and died when I was at the Centers for Disease Control on a fellowship. So I got home in Atlanta traffic. I know, what bad timing. I got home and I called my boss. I said, "Please don't run the wire story. We have a story that I wrote." He said, "I know. I'm reading it right now." It ran 5 feet.
Wow,
in column
which,
inches.
As we all know, is quite a bit of real
it's
estate
a lot of real
in
estate.
A newspaper.
No,
these
but I'm
days,
really proud of that one because I got to give the measure of her work. And for the book, I did it not only because I'm proud of it, but also because the book is published by the University Press of Mississippi. So I thought it'd be politic to include a Mississippi subject.
Great Mississippi subject, indeed.
Oh, yes.
Now, you've also had the responsibility of writing obituaries for journalistic colleagues. Iris Kelso, Jack Dempsey, Walter Cowan, Marjorie Roll. That must be a special kind of responsibility, don't you think?
It can be tough. Because there is the burden of doing obituaries to people I know and know well, because I want to be sure I am inclusive. I'm including as many facets of the personality as I can think of, and I'll beat myself up about this. So if I can have time, it's great. But people, again, warp and woof. Jack Dempsey, mm-hmm. who was on the States item, the police reporter when I started out, he was from the Irish Channel. He would say, "Poppy, did someone call me?" Or, "X in a loud stentorian verse if somebody called." And he always signed his dispatches on the teletype from the police press room, ALIHOT, which stood for a legend in his own time.
Oh, yes.
And at every States item party, he could be relied upon to sing "Every Man a King."
Sweet. That's a useful thing to bring to a party.
And only Jack.
Of course.
No, and he was just a wonderful throwback to an era when afternoon newspapers reigned. And he knew people like Leapin' Lumacina, Cream Cheese Louie, and just these Damon Runyon-esque characters. And he always wore a straw Katie in the summer.
Oh, sweet. Now, you also have some really wonderful examples of great New Orleans funerals in this book, which you were present.
Oh, yes. I picked them because as I was culling material for the book, I wanted to show the distinctive ways in which we honor our dead.
Yes.
And the four funerals are Warren McDaniels, who was the first African-American fire chief, Revius Ortik, who was the first African-American elected to the state Supreme Court, and Lindy Boggs, and, of course, Al Copeland.
Of course, the over-the-top.
Way over the top. I mean, dozens of Bentleys outside Holy Name Church, and in the style of the pharaohs, his toys were lined up out around the tomb in Metairie Cemetery, the jet skis, the boats, the motorcycles. And in came this glass-walled, horse-drawn hearse, the bronze coffin gleaming inside, and a band was playing something appropriately slow, probably a closer walk with thee. And because Mr. Al loved racing, everyone at the tomb was given a black and white finish line flag. And then balloons were released, doves were released, and the casket was put inside the tomb. Now, jazz funeral protocol dictates that once this person is free of earthly cares, you play something happy. So what did the band launch into? Love That Chicken from Popeyes.
Yes.
And I remember standing in Metairie Cemetery saying to myself, Pope, you can't make this stuff up.
I know. We do that often in New Orleans anyway, don't we?
Oh, yeah. And then at Revius Ortik's service, I mean, there was a lot of good oratory there. But the thing that just clutched my heartstrings was in the cortege on the way to, I think it was St. Louis number 3 near City Park. I love being in corteges because you can blow through stoplights.
Oh, yeah.
It's wonderful. Anywho, we were going along, and this man in a tattered T-shirt and shorts, he obviously had no idea who was passing by, but he did something that the perennially proper Justice Ortik would have approved of. He took off his baseball cap and put it over his heart.
Oh, so dear. Now, there's one other unusual trend in New Orleans funerals lately, and you make reference to that in Mickey Easterling's obituary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as her own daughter told me, her mother craved attention, and she certainly got it. Being propped up on a bench on the Sanger Theater stage with a cigarette holder in one hand and a glass of champagne in the other. It was done for also for Uncle Lionel Batiste, and it's kind of jarring.
To be present at the funeral. You think Al Copeland's spinning somewhere going, I wish I'd thought of that?
No, because by the time he died, Al Copeland was, he'd been pretty well ravaged by cancer. I mean, the irony of this man whose livelihood depended on his sense of taste, he had cancer of the salivary glands.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and he'd gone to Lourdes, and he'd wanted to meet the Pope, but he met Monsignor Nalty from New Orleans, who was in Rome at the time. Monsignor Nalty said at the funeral it was probably just as well because Al didn't speak foreign language and the Pope didn't speak no yat.
Well, I have to ask, so have you written your own obituary?
Yes, I did.
Last word ever.
Well, yes. No, I wrote it before I went on my Centers for Disease Control Fellowship in 2001 because I didn't know where I'd wind up. And then I revised it last month because I went to Tanzania and Kenya for 18 days. And I was sure I'd come back. But a
I'm
lot
glad
of,
you came back.
Why, thank you. A lot had happened in the intervening years. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, I hope we have to wait to read that one a really long time.
Me too.
Well, this is a wonderful book that is full of life. We've been talking with John Pope, whose new book is Getting Off at Elysian Fields, Obituaries from the New Orleans Times-Picayune. It's New Orleans through and through. Pope appears Tuesday, October 13th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library Coffee and Conversation Series, sponsored by the Library and the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. And again, Wednesday, October 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Pope, thank you so much.
Enjoyed this immensely.
Like I said, you know I'm almost dead, you know I'm almost gone. And when the drummer drums, he's gonna play my song to carry me along. Like I said, you know I'm almost dead, you know I'm almost gone. Like like I said, you know I'm almost dead, you know I'm almost gone.
Award-winning environmental photographer Cece Lockwood has been exploring the natural glories of Louisiana for more than 40 years. He's brought us such fantastic books as Marsh Mission, Capturing the Vanishing Wetlands, Cece Lockwood's Atchafalaya, and one of my very favorites, Cece Lockwood's Louisiana Nature Guide. He is a great advocate for our state, and in his new book, Louisiana Wild, The Protected and Restored Lands of the Nature Conservancy, he shows us some great efforts that are underway to save the beauty of our state. Cece Lockwood, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Well, thanks, Susan. It's great to be on with you.
Now, Keith Ouchley, the executive director of the Louisiana Nature Conservancy, has written the foreword to this book and accompanied you on some of your journeys. So tell us a little bit about how this partnership came about.
Well, the Nature Conservancy is one of my favorite environmental groups, and I've followed them and supported them for years. In fact, back 27 years ago when they were starting the Louisiana group, I loaned them a slideshow of pictures that they used to go around and drum up interest. So I'd say about the spring of 2013, I got together with Keith and their philanthropy director, Don, and just said, you know, we ought to go in partners, and you have wonderful land, you're doing a wonderful job, and I could photograph it and write about it. And it started from there.
And you had some great feelings about doing this project. I know. I love the way you described it.
Well, you know, I'd rather be outside than in, and to go on their beautiful properties and spend, it was planned on a year, but I spend a little more to be outdoors every day. It's just like I said, just like a dog behind the counter in a butcher shop.
I know. I love that. And you cover a lot of land in a lot of different parts of the state because the holdings are pretty vast, aren't they?
Well, they're vast in Louisiana and much vaster worldwide with the Nature Conservancy. I went to 33 parishes. They're involved in over 60 different tracts of land, 21 that they own in full fee title, and you know, others they've helped other organizations get, or ones they've bought temporarily and sold to somebody else to take care of it. And finally, they have easements with landowners that want their land to stay natural and beautiful. And they sign an easement off to the Nature Conservancy, and the land stays in the form that they writ in that easement.
Now, another thing that I love about Louisiana Wild is that this is really the good news about what's happening in our state.
It sure is. You know, I started out in the Atchafalaya Basin, and it's just a wonderful place, and it's huge. And it's had some problems, but just being undeveloped in a subdivision or farm situation, it is safe and secure. But when Katrina and the oil spill came along, and I kind of felt that I needed to go to do that environmentally, it was just a downer. I mean, you know, you being from New Orleans, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Katrina and the oil spill affected a lot of the Gulf Coast. So I'm so happy to be doing a positive book on an organization that's doing a great job in beautiful lands.
Now, you begin your journey with a chapter about Cypress Island, and that's a bird lover's paradise and one of the Nature Conservancy's properties that's open to the public.
Yeah, that's what they call their platform preserve, and they have a couple others in the state, one near Abita Springs called Abita Creek, which is totally different. But Cypress Island is just a marvelous place to be so close to so many people, and it offers so many different wild things, especially birds.
And I love it when there's one point where you mention, you know, your hope of seeing an ivory-billed woodpecker. If anybody can do that, it ought to be you, Cece. I mean, you're out there all the time.
I know, and that's negatively, that's why I think it's gone. But we all have hope, and they've had these sightings over the last 10 years in Arkansas and Florida and even in the Pearl River area, which none have been photographed and confirmed. But we sure hope that it's still out there. With lands like the Nature Conservancy land, we have a chance for that bird to have a habitat.
Let's keep our fingers crossed. Now, you also have a special section devoted to efforts to save the longleaf pine.
Yeah, that's one of the Nature Conservancy's priorities. The longleaf pine once ranged from northern Virginia all the way to southeast Texas, covering millions and millions of acres. And there's less than 5% of that virgin longleaf pine forest. And it's the heart pine, the pine that really built America. And it's a valuable tree, a beautiful tree, has a very interesting habitat, a relationship with fire, and the trees are more spread out, and there's a savanna under them with all kinds of orchids and different wildflowers and coniferous plants. So it's quite an exciting habitat, and we're building a lot of that back.
And you take some pictures of a controlled burn, and I loved seeing how resilient the pitcher plants were. They came back so quickly.
Yeah, they sure did. You know, they say that about every 2 years, a lot of lands in the United States burn by lightning fires. The Native Americans started fires to have the land grow back with fresh tubers and plants that they ate. And we finally figured out in the last 30, 40 years that a lot of our habitats need fire to survive. And longleaf pine is an extreme example of that.
Well, the other thing that I thought was so charming is that here we all are. We're longing for fall weather. We're longing for leaves to change. And you take us to Bayou Dorchit, which you say rivals anything in New England.
It does most years, and I happen to hit it on a lucky year where all North Louisiana, a little bit of South, had some extremely good fall colors. And it was just electric, the two or three trips I floated down Dorchit in the fall of 2013 and 14. Just the red of the black gum, the yellow of the sugar maples, it just goes on and on. It was just gorgeous.
And tell us about shadow shine. I thought that was such a poetic and lovely term for a particular kind of light.
One of the donors that has an easement of the Nature Conservancy is a doctor in Ruston. And he pointed out, said, "Cece, can you photograph that shadow shine?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And I looked by this little creek on his property, and there it was, the light reflecting off the creek and wiggling up and down the tree trunks. And I said, "I've seen that all my life. I've tried to photograph it, and I never knew to call it anything." And Johnny Armstrong's his name. He's written a novel about animals in the woods, and he calls it shadow shine. So since then, I notice it a lot more, and I've shot movies, and I've got it on still cameras, too.
Well, it's pure poetry. I love that part. So, and one of the most unusual projects that you take us to is Mollisey Farm, where a great bayou restoration project is underway.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. And, you know, right when I started out in the Atchafalaya, the soybean prices had skyrocketed, and they just went crazy clearing hardwood bottomland swamps. Same as the longleaf pine. There's about 5% of the historic bottomland swamps from Illinois down to Louisiana and Mississippi. The most interesting thing at Mollisey Farm is the Nature Conservancy and the Fish and Wildlife Service building Mollisey Bayou back. When those farmers came in, they just bulldozed that bayou down to nothing, filled it in. They went back in with core samples to find out exactly where that bayou was, and using the same machinery that you use to destroy land, they dug Mollisey Bayou back. Volunteers have planted cypress and water-torn oaks along the banks. And someday soon, it'll be a beautiful bayou again running into the Ouachita River.
Well, those are some of the photographs that I thought were the most striking, so interesting. Now, your goal, as always, in this book, as in all your others, is to really get people to appreciate this landscape, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. And to me, it's worth it just being beautiful. But you know and I know that the forest, the waters, and everything, they produce oxygen. It's just good to have some wild lands.
It's a beautiful book, and it is such a pleasure to look through it. It made me want to hit the trail. We've been talking with photographer Cece Lockwood, whose gorgeous new book is Louisiana Wild, The Protected and Restored Lands of the Louisiana Nature Conservancy. You can meet him Thursday, October 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Cece, thank you so much.
Well, Susan, just enjoy our wild Louisiana.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Sybil Morial discusses and signs Witness to Change, from Jim Crow to Political Empowerment, Tuesday, October 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. The 1718 Reading Series hosts a reading by newly named poet laureate Peter Cooley, Tuesday, October 6th at 7 at the Collins Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue. Margaret Eby signs South Toward Home, Travels in Southern Literature, Wednesday, October 7th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. The UNO Creative Writing Workshop hosts a reading by poets Derek Harriel and Sarah Slaughter, Wednesday, October 7th at 8, in the UNO Lakeside Campus Liberal Arts Building, Room 197. Today's guest, Cece Lockwood, signs Louisiana Wild, The Protected and Restored Lands of the Nature Conservancy, Thursday, October 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael Llewellyn signs Creole Sun, a novel of Degas in New Orleans, and C.G. Ware signs That Winter in Venice, Thursday, October 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Romance Writers of America present a special event Friday, October 9th at 6 at Octavia Books, featuring Gina Mann, author of Drift and Impulsive, Lenora Mangano, Teresa Weaver, author of A Home for Dixie and Blessed Be, all from the Crossroads chapter of Indiana. Appearing with them are South Louisiana chapter members Colleen Mooney, author of Rescued by a Kiss and Dead and Breakfast, and Don Chartier, Bewitching the Enemy, Masquerading with the CEO, and author Fiona Ripley. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Apex by Ramiz Nam, Saturday, October 10th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. And don't forget to stop by Octavia Books Saturday, October 10th from noon to 3 as they celebrate their 15th anniversary. Birthday cake for everyone, and you're encouraged to come dressed as your favorite literary character. There will be an open mic Sunday, October 11th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Kristen Hirsch signs Don't Suck, Don't Die, Giving Up Vic Chestnut, Monday, October 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Chelsea Clinton signs It's Your World, Get Informed, Get Inspired, and Get Going, Tuesday, October 13th at 5:30 at Octavia Books. This is a ticketed event. Cynthia Lejeune Noble signs A Confederacy of Dunces Cookbook, Recipes from Ignatius J. Riley's New Orleans, Tuesday, October 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, John Pope, signs Getting Off at Elysian Fields, Obituaries from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Wednesday, October 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. And coming up later this month, Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans presented by the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, celebrates its 25th anniversary. It takes place October 29th through November 2nd, and appropriately, the theme this year is Out of This World, the Otherworldly in Literature and Life. Featured guests include psychic Carrie Roy channeling William Faulkner, Mary Arno, John Biganay, Elise Blackwell, Brian Boyles, Lori Carlson, Jack Davis, Sally Ann Glassman, Sybil Morial, Michael Murphy, Tom Piazza, Bruce Jones, Julie Smith, Tony Dunbar, Mary Helen Lagasse, and Jenny Tilbury. For more information, check out wordsandmusic.org. The Louisiana Book Festival takes place October 31st on the Capitol grounds in Baton Rouge. Tom Piazza receives the Louisiana Writer Award at 10 a.m. in the House Chamber. Other writers scheduled to appear during the day include Rick Bragg, our new state poet laureate Peter Cooley, Ravi Howard, Jamie Attenberg, Skip Horak, Yusuf Komunyaka, Jamie Cornegay, New Yorker comma queen Mary Norris, who will be interviewed by John Pope, Jewel Parker Rhodes, Cokie Roberts, T. Geronimo Johnson, Kimberly Willis Holt, and Emma Walsh. Check out LouisianaBookFestival.org for the complete schedule. And you know Halloween means vampires and ghosts and things that go bump in the night. Check out the schedule for Undead Con for fans of Anne Rice in particular and horror literature in general. The event takes place October 29th through November 1st, and complete listings are at arvlfc.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.